This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, last night, President Obama gave a State of the Union address calling for a new era of cooperation.
And it was an unusual address. The congressmen and women crossed party lines to sit together, perhaps a sign of this new era of cooperation. Nonetheless, they have huge challenges as they struggle with reducing that federal deficit and still follow through on this investment in our future that was so talked about last night.
Well, they sat together last night, but as the president said, can they work together today? He also spoke about the need for more than just cooperation to win the future. We need to focus in on the great American tradition of innovation.
And I thought, Mark, one of his quotable moments was that in America, innovation doesn't just change our lives. It's actually how we make a living. It's also about how we improve healthcare at Community Health Center. And that's a key focus of our show, innovation.
It is absolutely with us. And it's also true that innovation takes place in many levels. We see some exciting activity coming out of the states. Vermont is an example. They're a front runner in creating a single payer option for their residents. The effort has progressed through some legislative maneuvering within the current law. We'll see if Vermont's innovation is something that gets allowed in our federal system.
And we didn't hear so much about federal health reform last night, though it was touched on, but we're seeing innovation there too. To foster innovation, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden, Republican Senator Scott Brown are demonstrating a little cooperation of their own with the Wyden-Brown bill, and that would give states greater flexibility with the law, using federal dollars to help finance their own approach to reaching the coverage objectives of health reform. We'll see where it goes, but it's an example of people working together across party lines to find solutions everybody can live with.
We like that bipartisan spirit. Staying on the topic of the role states play in innovating health care reform, today we're speaking with Alan Weil, Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. We'll be talking about how states are leading the way with health care reform and innovation and about what's in store as they move federal health care reform forward this year.
We are very glad that Alan can be with us today. And no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. Subscribe to iTunes, get the show regularly downloaded, or if you like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of the shows, visit us at chcradio.com. And don't forget, you can be a fan of Conversations on Healthcare on Facebook and join the discussion on Twitter.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with Alan Weil, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. President Obama defended the health care overhaul against Republican repeal efforts in his State of the Union address Tuesday night, but also clarified a willingness to work together with Republicans.
If you have ideas about how to improve this law by making care better or more affordable, I am eager to work with you. We can start right now by correcting a flaw in the legislation that has placed an unnecessary bookkeeping burden on small businesses.
The president went on to address the country's mounting debt crisis. He said health care reform would slow rising health care costs and suggested looking to other ideas, like one Republicans have mentioned, to reform medical malpractice to rein in frivolous lawsuits. A bipartisan effort is mounting as Democrats back their Republican colleagues in repealing a provision in the Affordable Care Act. The provision would require all businesses, nonprofits, and governments to file 1099 tax forms, reporting any purchases they make of goods or services above $600. Small businesses are complaining that this will be expensive and labor-intensive. Republican, as well as several Democratic lawmakers, are saying the economy will recover more quickly and more jobs will be created if regulations on businesses like this one are reduced. The measure was designed to raise $17 billion over the next 10 years to fund the new health care law by cracking down on tax evasion. The Republican-led House recently voted to repeal the entire health care bill, but the Democratic-majority Senate has no plans to bring that up for a vote. Although previous attempts to repeal the 1099 provision have failed, approval of a standalone bill now appear likely. Democrat Max Baucus introduced his own version of the 1099 repeal with several co-sponsors, and he says he hopes Democrats and Republicans can come together to pass the legislation quickly. Walmart has announced efforts to get consumers to eat healthier foods. The U.S. retail giant is teaming up with First Lady Michelle Obama and her campaign to fight childhood obesity with a five-year plan to lower salt, fat, and sugar in its packaged foods, as well as drop prices on fruits and vegetables sold in its stores. The First Lady says this change has the power to make a huge impact on the health of Americans.
The largest corporation in America is launching a new initiative that has the potential to transform the marketplace and to help American families put healthier food on their tables.
The partnership is the result of over a year of work together between the First Lady's Let's Move campaign and Walmart.
Conversations on Healthcare. Today, we're speaking with Alan Weil, Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. He's a member of the Institute of Medicine's Board on Healthcare Services, the Commonwealth Fund's Commission on High Performance Health Systems, and the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and Uninsured. Welcome, Alan. Looks like this may be a very busy year as elected officials try to work through the practical issues around healthcare reform, and I guess at the same time wonder what changes Congress might make. And this is where the National Academy for State Health Policy comes in. You work with state leaders to solve critical health issues facing states. Could you start out by outlining the major issues you expect officials to deal with and why states are such critical players in healthcare?
States have a tremendous role in implementing the new health care law. States have always been major actors in the health field. They run the Medicaid program, which serves low-income people and elders and people with disabilities. They regulate health care providers. They run medical schools, and the list goes on and on. In the new law, states have a number of responsibilities that are going to take their attention over the next few years. Quite a bit of attention is focused now on establishing what are called health insurance exchanges, which is a marketplace where people who don't have coverage through their job can obtain coverage and people can get access to federal tax credit subsidies to apply to the cost of coverage. There's a significant expansion in the Medicaid program, and that means states need to simplify and integrate the eligibility for the Medicaid program with the eligibility for subsidies for middle-class families and find providers, sufficient providers to deliver health care services to all of the newly eligible folks. There's a significant increase in regulation of health insurance providers around rates and other practices, and states are the front line of insurance regulation. Those are the highlights, but there are public health initiatives, there are data improvement initiatives, there are many other aspects to the law that states are involved in.
Alan, it seems to me we're entering a period of a lot of push and pull. We have states and the federal government certainly pushing forward strongly to implement federal health care reform, and certainly we have some efforts to pull it back. And one thing that's for sure is the public is likely to be somewhat confused. So one of the top priorities, I think, of the National Academy is to engage the public in policy development and in implementation. We'd be curious about what your strategies are for bringing people, bringing the American public into these important conversations.
The public at large certainly needs to be involved in many different ways. And then, of course, the healthcare sector, the delivery system, the hospitals, the doctors, the nurses, they also need to be involved because there are significant changes in what they're expected to do. And over the long term, certainly the reform anticipates putting into place changes that will affect their world in very significant ways. What we see when we look around the country is that states are doing the things you might expect them to do on a sensitive and highly visible issue. They're holding public hearings and forums. They're having, we'll expect a lot of legislative hearings. And I think, and they're putting consumers and other health sector representatives on committees that are charged with defining the state's approach to implementation. There is a lot of work to be done in this area.
You know, one of the initiatives that the National Academy for State Health Policy undertook was your Assuring Better Child Health and Development, your ABCD program, which is focused in on children birth to three and improving the delivery system for child development in primary care. Can you tell us about some of the best practices you're seeing across the country as this program's now about a decade old?
The focus of the current effort is around linkages between pediatric practices and the developmental services that are available in states. It turns out that, you know, if you walk into a typical one or two or three pediatrician office practice, you know, they're busy taking care of the health needs of their kids, and the less frequently observed social delays or emotional delays that go beyond what the pediatrician can take care of, they may be isolated from what the community resources are. So much of what the ABCD program is about, and frankly, so much of what's exciting in healthcare these days, is moving outside of the traditional practice, thinking about the broader needs of the patient in the context of ABCD, this is young children, and realizing that there are resources out there that often are outside of what the typical healthcare provider is paying attention to on a daily basis, but they're out there. And if we can help build those linkages, then we can take better care of patients.
Alan, certainly you can't talk about health reform without talking about innovation, and we always say that every state in America is a laboratory for innovation. You've worked with the Commonwealth Fund on a report that looked at how a diverse group of states is trying to reorganize the delivery of primary care and chronic care services. Tell us about that, and what are you seeing that's really promising in terms of innovations from these states?
What's happening in the most innovative locations is that the various payers for healthcare, that's often at the state level, the anchor is the Medicaid program, but it's also insurance plans and private companies that are paying for health insurance for their employees. They're coming together and saying, we want a greater emphasis on primary care. We want a greater emphasis on care coordination. These are services that are not readily reimbursed in the traditional medical claims processing systems in our insurance plans. So we're going to come together and fund with an assessment on all of us who are payers, a fund. So for example, in Pennsylvania, you have a little pot of money that's being used to go out region by region at the peer level, helping practices learn how to convert themselves into centers that are able to offer a broader range of services and a more comprehensive set of supports to the patients that are served by them. It's the little daily practices that create an infrastructure that enable a physician's practice to be more productive, more comprehensive, more patient-centered. That is a movement going on around the country. It falls in, it has a number of different names, and it comes in different structures. But the notion of moving out of this, moving patients through the door, billing for the procedure, seeing the next patient into a broader view, that's where some of the most interesting innovation is happening these days.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Alan Weil, Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. Alan, the Academy wrote a roadmap, if you will, for states to implement health reform and really laid out 10 goals for states to be successful. I think they covered the waterfront from being strategic with insurance exchanges to expanding provider and health system capacity to focusing on the dually eligible. But we were particularly interested in your thoughts on the use of data and pursuing population health goals. Why is this such an important area for states to improve, and how can they begin to do so?
It's one of my favorite areas to work on, and part of the frustration of the current debate in healthcare is that we always go back to issues of coverage and cost, and they're so important. But in fact, when you talk to people about what's important to them, it's their health, and it is the ability to afford access to the services they need. But at the end of the day, they want those services so they can have their health. I think there are two aspects that bring the data and the population health pieces together. One is they create a focal point for action and accountability that's far more meaningful to the public than talking about health insurance exchanges, which it seems like I spend most of my time doing these days. We should be able to look out in a community and identify the burden of illness that is most of concern to us and say, let's align the forces of the healthcare system, but also go outside of the healthcare system to reduce that burden, whether it's pediatric asthma or uncontrolled diabetes. Pick your burden. It does vary by community. And actually, this is where the data and the population health come together. Use the increased investments that are being made every day in the information infrastructure to not just look at claims, as in, did someone come in to get their blood pressure checked, but what was the value of that check to determine whether or not their blood pressure, their high blood pressure is being controlled, and start building a community-oriented focus on reducing the negative consequences of disease. That is a very powerful motivator for improvement.
Alan, one of the areas that we haven't focused so much on the show, and I don't think has been so much part of the public debate, is that of long-term care, which, given what a huge financial burden and what it means just in terms of people's lives, probably one we should be putting more attention on. Some of the provisions in the health reform bill that take effect starting this year really address long-term care, allowing Medicaid enrollees to designate a home health care service as a provider allowing states to receive 90% federal matching payments for 2 years for home health related care. Can you tell us a little bit about how the National Academy for State Health Policy has been working on the issues of long-term care and maybe explain to our listeners a little bit about what these provisions mean?
There are many new provisions. One you didn't mention is the CLASS Act, which is a voluntary long-term care insurance program that people can pay into to give them a benefit should their functional status reach a point where they need help. There's also the creation of a new office of dual eligibles. If you're low-income elder on Medicare, but you're also, because you're of your health status and your income, eligible for Medicaid, you're what we call a dually eligible person. These are often people with very frail or with dementia or other or physical deterioration to a point where their health and social needs are quite significant. And we run these two separate programs, Medicare and Medicaid. They haven't historically worked together too well, and now we have a new office focused exclusively on trying to coordinate between those. There's movement towards increased use of the so-called medical home model and care coordination for this population. What's interesting to me is that other than the CLASS Act, which is brand new, most of what's in the federal law is a continuation of a direction that states have already been going. So there's an expansion, for example, of a program called Money Follows the Person, which helps people move back into the community from the nursing home. But that program existed before health reform. It's now expanded and the people eligible for it grows. Really, the issue here is states have, and it's the work we've been doing for decades with the states, is states have to build an infrastructure of community supports for people who want to live in their home, which is almost everybody.
We like to ask all of our guests this question in conversations. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
Well, you're talking about a seventh of the economy when it comes to healthcare, so there's a tremendous amount of innovation. And the ones that excite me the most are around engagement with patients. I am struck by how much of the healthcare discussion is talks about providers, talks about how we pay them, how we structure them, what the insurance coverage looks like. And then we had this movement to sort of patient, to what was called consumer-directed care, but it became a shorthand for high-deductible insurance where people had to pay for their care. I think consumer engagement is not just about paying. It's not primarily about paying. It's truly about engaging patients for who they are, for what their preferences are. There's very interesting work going on now to give patients more information about their treatment options. We've had sort of the ugly side of the national debate about end-of-life care, but people really do want to engage about their treatment preferences at the end of life. But it's throughout their lives, throughout the healthcare system. I really think true patient engagement, not just in a financial way, but in a healthcare way, is the frontier of healthcare. Those are small conversations going on around the country and around the world, but I think we're going to see more and more attention on that one.
Today, we've been speaking with Alan Weil, Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
This week's bright idea focuses on a hospital-based violence prevention program that's tackling the roots of repeated violent injuries. In the 1990s, physicians and nurses at the University of Maryland Medical Center in Baltimore were quite used to treating and releasing victims of violent crimes, only to see them return several months later with even worse injuries. But after experiencing this vicious cycle for years, Dr. Carnell Cooper, an associate professor of surgery at the university, decided that he and his colleagues needed to reach out to their community and address the problem at its sources: poverty, substance abuse, crime, and mental illness. In 1998, Dr. Cooper created the Violence Intervention Program, or VIP. When patients are hospitalized with intentional traumatic violent injuries, they are encouraged to join the VIP. Upon enrolling, they receive an individual action plan designed by the program's team of social workers, parole and probation officers, and physicians specializing in psychiatry, trauma, epidemiology, and preventative health. During and after the patient's stay in the hospital, this team meets with them regularly to help reduce the likelihood of recidivism. In addition to the treatment and therapy the team provides, they also help patients gain access to services like substance abuse rehabilitation, job training, family counseling, and GED tutoring. In the 13 years since the program began, there has been an 83% decrease among participants in repeat hospitalizations for violent injuries, a 75% reduction in criminal activity in the area, and an 82% increase in employment. Although it started ahead of the curve, Dr. Cooper's program is now one of the many hospital-based violence prevention programs around the country. By viewing repeat hospitalizations for violent injuries as a problem rooted in the community rather than isolated incidents, these programs are reducing crime and improving the health and cohesion of communities across the country. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.